Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by our neighbors, Fine and Raw Chocolate, producers of the most delicious bean-to-bar chocolates in Brooklyn. For more information, visit fineandraw.com.
Hey, this is Hannah Forden. I'm the program manager here at Heritage Radio Network. This year, we're celebrating HRN's 10th anniversary, and I want to thank all of our listeners and members for being a part of an incredible year of food radio. We never would have made it this far without all of you. So HRN is now in its summer fund drive, and this is when we turn to you and ask that you make a donation to help ensure a bright future for food radio. Whether you listen to one show or 20, there's a reason why you keep tuning in week after week. All of our content is powered by a small nonprofit, and we rely on your generosity to keep going. Help us keep broadcasting the most thought-provoking, entertaining, and educational conversations happening in the world of food and beverage. So become a member today. To celebrate our 10th anniversary, we have some brand new member gifts available online, so I encourage you to snag your new favorite pizza-themed t-shirt or enamel pin today and show the world how much you love HRN. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate so you can snag your 10th anniversary member swag. And thank you.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Esther Mobley. We'll talk to Esther about wine, writing about wine, women in wine, and a lot more. I hope we can get to everything. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Massachusetts-born Esther Mobley is the wine critic at the San Francisco Chronicle. After finishing Smith College, Esther pursued a path in wine, working harvests, wine shops, restaurants, interning at one wine magazine, assistant editor at another, and now the San Francisco Chronicle. Esther Mobley looks at wine not just as a story, but through the people, place, and culture. Esther predominantly covers California wine in addition to beer, spirits, and drinking culture for the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Esther.
Hi, Sam. It's great to be here.
I'm excited about the show. I've been wanting to talk to you for a while. There's a lot of stuff I want to cover with you and get your take on. But before we jump into everything, I want you to give the listeners a little background in your journey in life and wine that currently got you at the wine critic desk at the San Francisco Chronicle. How'd we get there?
Kind of haphazardly and gradually, but I wanted to be a writer my whole life. That was my dream. And for a while, it seemed like that was kind of an unrealistic dream in terms of a profession. I mean, I just thought, it's like being a musician or wanting to be an actor. You know, a lot of people want to do this and very few people actually make a living at it. So I assumed that I would write on the side. It would kind of be a hobby. And that's why I didn't initially try to pursue a job related to it right after college. I had been an English major at Smith. I studied literature and you know, I was at a liberal arts college that didn't really give a lot of guidance as to what you were going to do after school. It was
just funny.
Trying to encourage you to open your mind while you were there. And it was really on a lark that I started kind of searching around the internet for wine jobs. I didn't know anything about wine. I didn't grow up in a household that really drank wine. I drank wine like a lot of college students drink wine as a kind of party lubricant.
Right.
But there was certainly no real interest in it or knowledge basis or mentor in my life. And I kind of started poking around. Somehow the idea just sounded romantic to me. And once I discovered that there was such a position as a harvest intern, someone who would, you know, get to sign on for a few months working on a vineyard, that just sounded like the dream post-college gap year activity to me. I mean, I know most people who are harvest interns are really serious, you know, aspiring winemakers on a career track, but I just thought that sounds better than the Peace Corps or Teach for America or...
No kidding.
You know, yeah.
Was this the... Did you do the harvest right after senior year?
Yes. Well, yeah. So I started in August after my senior year. And I was just kind of bumbling around the internet trying to figure out how to make this happen once it got into my mind. But I ended up finding a Smith alumna, Helen Keplinger, who's a winemaker in Napa.
Helen was?
I had no idea. I mean...
Wow.
I just had no idea. At the time, she was the winemaker for Bryant Estate, really obviously highly respected winery, and that meant nothing to me. I mean, I just thought, oh, cool, here's an alumna who her job title in the alumni database says winemaker. So I cold called her, and she, like a lot of Smith graduates tend to be, was immediately so eager to help me and said, what can I do? Ask me anything you need. Let me help introduce you to some people. And she really helped me make it happen. And she certainly didn't have to. And she's done that, by the way, for a number of other Smith graduates.
Nice.
She's really helped a lot of women.
Nice. So you do your first harvest.
So I moved. Yeah, I had never been to California before. I grew up in Massachusetts. I went to school in Massachusetts. And you might imagine what Napa seemed like to me. I mean, I just felt like this was the dream. What an amazing, beautiful place. I had never seen any place like it. I was surrounded by people who were making a career in wine, which I just had no basis for even knowing that was a possibility for anyone's life. And I got to work with my hands. I mean, you know, I hadn't had a lot of jobs before that where I was really being physical and outdoors. I had never taken a science class in all of college, thanks to liberal arts education. And suddenly I was learning how to do lab work. I mean, it was really just wonderful. It was a really great experience, and I fell in love with it. And I was surrounded by people who were serious about this, who were, you know, several of my other harvest interns had master's degrees from Davis, and they were really intelligent, talented, ambitious people. And I just thought, whoa, okay, this is cool. Maybe this is a career path.
So that wasn't necessarily the defining moment, but it certainly sealed your interest to probably stay with it and move forward in wine, right?
Yes, yes. About halfway through that fall, so, I mean, how long is a harvest job? Maybe 5 months or so. I started applying for harvest internships in the Southern Hemisphere so that I could continue learning. And I very nearly went to New Zealand. I got an internship there, but in the end, I went to Mendoza, Argentina.
Beautiful.
And yeah, it really is beautiful.
Where did you work there?
I have to go back. I worked at The name of the winery is Bodega Roland. It is Michel Roland's winery in Mendoza. But there's no real wines from that winery don't bear that domain name. The main wine that gets exported to the U.S. that comes out of there is called Clos de los Siete, and it's actually a kind of collaborative wine from these five adjacent estates. It's in the Uco Valley. It's near the town of Vista Flores.
Right.
Really beautiful. I mean, I lived in a little hut in the middle of a vineyard and could see the Andes Mountains from my bedroom. It was really, really beautiful. And such a different type of place. I mean, I had been in Napa in 2011, which was this harvest of rain and mold, and everyone was worried about botrytis. And Argentina was this kind of more arid, mountainous. It was just a different place. I kept asking, are you worried about botrytis? Because that was all I knew. And they were like, we haven't gotten that in 20 years.
That's funny. So you good side by side work in Napa and Argentina. You know, you were exposed to a lot of different things. You finish that up, and what do? You obviously have to head back, right?
I had to head back, and for who knows now, it's hard to really remember what was going through my head then, but for whatever reason, I kind of decided I wasn't going to do another harvest. I loved wine, I knew, but I felt like I wasn't really cut out to be a winemaker, and I still felt at that point like my life was tethered to the East Coast. And so I moved back to Boston, where I'm from, and I got a job at a restaurant there called L'Espalier. It actually just recently closed, but really great restaurant, fine dining in downtown Boston with a really, really great wine list. And I don't think I had worked in restaurants before. I'd worked in restaurants in high school and through college as a server, but they gave me the job because I had wine experience, and I learned quite a lot about wine there. It was a really, you know, I mean, it was an environment with really top sommeliers and great food, and it felt like a kind of continuation of the wine education I'd been getting over the previous year.
How long did you do that?
I was there maybe, I mean, this is how quickly life moved in that period of time. It's hard to believe, but maybe 4 months or so.
Oh.
And I was looking, I mean, I was living with my parents. By that point, I was a year out of college, and it ended up being a helpful way station for me. But at the time, I just thought, is this what I'm going to do? I don't know. And I, on a whim, applied to an internship at Wine Enthusiast Magazine, which is in Westchester County. And that was kind of my first move into wine writing. In retrospect, I mean, if I ever advised...
That was in New York, right? So you came to New York?
Yeah.
Okay.
I moved to New York and for this internship. At that point, I didn't really know where that was going to go. And I had seen the internship job posting online wherever I saw it. And I just thought, whoa, wine and writing? Could I really potentially combine these two passions of mine? And so I applied to that. But it wasn't as if at that moment I had these grand plans of making a career as a wine writer. I was just kind of taking one step at a time, one job at a time, and thought that it sounded like a really fun environment to be in.
And it worked out to be that?
It was. I mean, they didn't offer me. I hoped they, you know, they kind of dangled a little, this could turn into a job in front of me, and it didn't. And so I got restless after a few months and was thinking, you know, I by then had moved into Manhattan and was commuting out to Westchester and felt like I needed a little more stability. And so I just thought, well, what has this qualified me for? I guess a job at another wine magazine. And so I was introduced to James Molesworth, who I know has been on your show.
Right. James,
not too
a
long
friend.
Ago.
Good guy.
Yeah. Helen introduced me to James, Helen Keplinger.
Right.
And I cold emailed him and said, hi, you know, I'm a young person who's become very interested in wine. I would love to be a wine writer. could I meet you? Would you talk to me? And he said, sure, we don't have any jobs available here, but come on in and we'll meet. So I came in and met with James Molesworth, and he was very kind to me. I mean, this was back when the offices used to be on Park Avenue.
Right.
And he said, well, okay. I mean, he kind of quizzed me a little. It was funny. I remember feeling a little self-conscious about, whoa, what was this? But he took me around and he introduced me to some other people in the office, including Tom Matthews, the executive editor.
Right.
And they were very kind to me, cordial to me. You know, I left and they said, okay, we'll see you. And I just thought, well, that's probably not going to turn into anything. And a few weeks later, it really wasn't very long after that, Tom called me and said, unexpectedly, we have a staff member who's leaving, a job's available. Would you like to come in and interview for it? And I said, how's tomorrow? and they offered me the job that day.
So the position was to assist Tom?
Exactly. I was to be his assistant. And it was clear to me that he made this very clear that he always hired assistants who he hoped would continue to advance through the editorial chain of command at the magazine. And sure enough, there were several people who had editorial roles there who had started off as his assistants. So I had a lot of confidence that if I put work in and really did my best, that there was going to be a possibility for me to advance. And there was. And within about 8 months, someone else above me left, and I got bumped up. And
bumped up to what?
That was where assistant editor.
Okay.
So I was in charge of a few of the front of book sections. I mean, if you open Wine Spectator,
right. There's little little short notices.
Pieces, what they call the grapevine, and before you get into the features. And so I was in charge of some of those pages. I was editing. I was pitching to other editors as much as I could. I was really hungry to write as much as I could. And I saw a really clear path there. I saw a lot of people like James who had started there in junior roles and had really advanced into really interesting roles. And I just thought, hey, if I stick around here, I can write features. I could get a tasting beat. I could, be scoring wine. And that was my goal. That was what I hoped to do.
And you were there, what, over 3 years? How did it work out in your mind?
Yeah, I was there about 3 years. And I was really happy there. I mean, at a certain point, and this is where I can't really tell you when did I know this was my career, because you start out having these kind of menial jobs, and then someone gives you a chance, and
right.
You take it. And soon enough, you say, hey, I'm good at this. I love doing this. And I started to just feel really fortunate that I had happened into this incredible niche. I mean, I just, kids probably don't grow up thinking, I want to be a wine writer. It's not
right.
Advertised at the career fair.
No.
And I felt really fortunate. And I thought, I'm in a place that's going to help mentor me through this.
Go ahead.
No, well, it's just to say I really had no designs on leaving. But when John Bonnet announced that he was going to be leaving the Chronicle, and I read his work, I admired his work, I had a moment in my head where I thought, jobs like these in this very niche, specialized field become available so rarely. If I don't at least throw my hat in the ring, I'll regret it, and another job might not pop up for 10 more years. So
that was the right attitude.
I'll give it a shot. Yeah. I'm really grateful it turned out well.
No, you threw your age, your sex, your experience to the wind and still applied, right?
Yeah. I mean, I thought there's no way I'm qualified for this. They're going to want someone who has a real name, who is kind of a known entity, who has an existing reputation, and I was a nobody. I see now that my kind of open-mindedness was something that worked in my favor, and that I hopefully conveyed to them I was eager to experiment and be different, and I was still finding my voice. I probably still am finding my voice.
Do you think that was, you know, they were looking for a little different direction than the past and saw all of that in you?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think they were really happy with John. I know they were.
Yeah.
And, of course, I mean, he took the San Francisco Chronicle, I think, into from you know, the Chronicle has always been really well-respected for its food section, and it's always been known to have a really fabulous food section. And still, we invest more than almost all newspapers in America in having vibrant food coverage. But I think John really made the wine coverage national, even international entity.
Right.
And I'm so grateful to him for that.
Plus the proximity to Napa, Sonoma, and all that became important.
Right.
All right, so they offer you the job, and that was, what, almost 3-4 years ago?
That was in 2015. So
2015.
In August, I'll have been in my job 4 years.
All right, so let's talk about that. Let's tell people, you know, what's your beat? What are you tasked to cover for the paper? You know, be specific.
So my title is wine critic, and when I started, my title was wine, beer, and spirits writer. And over time, I and my editors have kind of refined that to better suit, A, my interests and my skills, but also the, you know, the kind of priorities that the paper has in terms of our coverage. So I operate as part of our food team. We produce every Sunday the food and wine section that goes in the paper.
Right.
We have several staff writers, and in one sense, I'm just like any other beat reporter at the paper. My beat happens to be wine. And, you know, just like we cover the heck out of the Golden State Warriors,
right,
we think that, and, you know, Google and Salesforce, we think that wine is an incredibly important part of the Bay Area, Northern California's culture. It's a huge part of its economy. And so one thing that's really fun is that in addition to the main thing I do is producing features, but I write a lot of news too. And when things like the Northern California wildfires hit, or when Trump announces a new round of tariffs on wine. Major news stories. And that's just so thrilling for me. It's really fun to be a part of that. But the main part of, you know, the kind of core of what I do is producing features about wine and sometimes also about beer, spirits, bars for our Sunday food section. And I assign stories to freelancers. More and more, I write more of our wine coverage and assign out more of our other drinks coverage.
So here's where, I wouldn't say I'm a little confused, but I guess more curious. Your title is Wine Critic, and you even just explained it, and I don't see it as, you know, a wine critic. So how do you mostly see yourself? As a wine critic, as a wine writer, as a cultural critic slash writer, wine reviewer, something else? I know you're probably going to say all of the above, but, you know, where do you kind of see yourself?
It's an excellent question, and I, in a lot of ways, I see my, you know, the major work of my role is trying to define what I want that to be. But certainly I don't resemble a wine critic in the most traditional sense of that term.
Yes.
Which is the type of critic I might have become had I stayed at Wine Spectator, which is really providing wine reviews and scores.
Right.
Right. And it's interesting, Eric Asimov, another
just wrote an article.
Past guest, he had a great article. And of course his title is Wine Critic. And, he does star wines.
Right.
But I would say that's a pretty minor part of what he does. At least it looks like it from the outside.
He does wine school and features and all that, but he'll cover wine.
Yeah. Right. And he does, you know, he'll give kind of straight up wine recommendations.
Right.
And he had a great piece this week, I thought, about how we should maybe try to reconsider how we define the term wine critic. I mean, we have a new restaurant critic who just started a few months ago, Soleil Ho, and she's decided to do away with the star system. Mm. You know, we used to always award restaurant reviews on a basis of 4 stars, and we've done away with that. So I absolutely see myself as a critic in kind of one part of my job. The most important part of my job, I think, is being a wine critic. And yet, I think it's a different medium of criticism than what most wine criticism has been in the past. I think the term you use, cultural critic, gets close to what I really hope to be doing. I think there's a critical and kind of opinion-based, expert opinion-based way of thinking about the wine world. That's what I love writing about. I mean, that's what gets me out of bed in the morning, is trying to kind of look at these things and say, how should we be thinking about this? What are the types of questions we should be asking? And I'm not nearly as interested in telling people, is this a very good wine or merely a, you know, satisfactory wine? So I think that's kind of one part of it. But the coolest part about my job at the Chronicle is I don't really have to choose. I mean, I'm also a news reporter. I'm also a feature writer. And then I do make kind of straight up wine recommendations, what we call service journalism. I think that's incredibly important. Trying to tell people where to go, what to drink, what to spend their money on.
Right.
So I get to do a little bit of all that.
You know, I was going to ask you, you know, why is the Chronicle, why is their wine coverage different than other wine publications? I think you just answered that with the diversity and depth and all of that. But who's the audience you're writing to? I mean, there was that existing audience, there was John's audience, there's the paper's demo. But who are you writing to? Who do you think you have to write to?
Well, I wish I knew who that person, that kind of prototypical reader, was a little better. But the way I think about it is this. My primary mission is to write for the San Francisco Chronicle's readership. And we really are, in many ways, a regional paper. I think we're maybe the best regional paper in the country. And we cover what I think is one of the most fascinating places in the world, the San Francisco Bay Area, Northern California. This is the epicenter of so much, including American wine. And I think our readers are, I think of my reader as the kind of typical reader of the paper, which is a very intelligent, informed amateur when it comes to wine.
Right.
So the people who live in San Francisco are, for the most part, interested in drinking well, in eating well, in living a good life. They're willing probably to spend a little more money on luxuries like wine than people in other parts of the country. But I certainly don't expect everyone I know to have an advanced understanding of the intricacies of wine or the wine industry or winemaking.
Or the money, too.
Absolutely. And I try to really hold my subjects accountable for charging the kinds of prices they charge. I mean, everything here is inflated. Ultimately, real estate is inflated, and that drives a lot of things in California. But
you wrote about a very famous chef, that happens to be a woman, and in San Francisco, and sitting at the bar and having a little snack and a glass of wine. You know, this was San Francisco. Was, you know, astronomical, almost
$400.
Unrealistic, right?
Yeah.
So there's a little of that going on.
We feel like we're living in a bubble. I mean, it's just crazy. And you know, it's not just going out to restaurants in San Francisco. It's people who are buying vineyards in Napa and Sonoma. And I write a lot about that. I think that's, but so the readership question, I mean, what I hope is that by telling these stories about Northern California the best way we can, I think there's inherently national, international interest in that.
Agreed.
I mean, if you care about wine, you care about California wine, or at least you should care about California wine. And I think we have the resources and uh, the the potential to cover California wine better than anyone in the country. We're the paper of record for this region, and I can be in wine country in 45 minutes, and I spend a lot of time there, and I just think, and I have an amazing paper behind me with incredible editors, incredible photographers, a lot of reach, a lot of clout. And so I hope that we can win readers just because these are national stories ultimately.
And I agree with you. And, you know, we'll talk about it hopefully if we have time. And because of the internet, you know, you're not just getting this, you know, you're getting people who care about California wine, you know, that don't live there, that'll go there. But we'll get to that. Before we take a break, because we still have a lot to talk about, but I got a break. I want you to talk to me a little about the process of, you know, how you get a story published in the paper. I mean, does it come down to you pitching ideas? Are you assigned stories? I mean, do you have inspirations at night and you pursue them? Are you juggling, you know, a lot of different ideas? You know, and then give me a little sense of, you know, your writing philosophy and, you know, objectives sometimes. Because beyond wine, you know, I said in the intro, there's people, culture, place, and issues out there. So tell me a little about, you know, the process. There's some structure, I guess, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of structure. So I'm in an ongoing discussion all the time with my editor, Paolo Lucchesi, who oversees all our food coverage, of stories I want to write, stories I'm starting to write. And he gives me a lot of freedom. I mean, if I have a story idea, I might just start pursuing it and then start talking to him. But there's always many stories in the works. It's kind of ends up being this staggered process, partly because my stories tend to take longer to report than people who are reporters in the newsroom who are just turning over these daily quick news hits. And also because we have the luxury of that being one of the Sunday feature sections.
It took me a day to read that Renaissance cult winery piece. It seemed like it went on forever, but I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, well, that's an example of a piece that was in the works for 6 months. I've had many stories that are in the works for 6 months. It almost reminds me of when I used to work at magazines because that was about the lead time on those. In terms of ideas for stories to write, the little internal personal document I keep with all my story ideas, right now, if I didn't come up with a new idea for 5 years, I would have enough. I mean, there's just so many stories I want to write, and I'm waiting for the chance to, waiting for the time to. But when I have a great story idea, when I think the time is right for something, when I want to get to work on something, assuming it's not breaking news, because that you just drop everything and start, you pick up the phone. I'm constantly talking to my editor about it. He knows what I'm working on, and I want his feedback. I mean, I want his ideas and his kind of sensibilities to shape it. And I usually get to take my time. I mean, most stories require me to do at least a day, maybe multiple days of reporting. That's usually in wine country, you know, say
that means being with the subject or at the place type thing.
Yeah. So, again, I tend those. So I'm, you know, maybe on average one day a week, sometimes more. Sometimes there's a week when I'm not out of the office, but I'm usually somewhere at wineries most of the time. People I intend to write about, every story is different. I mean, some stories. You go up there, you spend an afternoon with the people, you kind of get their story, and then I can tell it. Other stories are really complicated and require a lot of other interviews, some of which can be done over the phone, some of which can't be. Right. And, I had a piece come out this week about Bryant Estate, which has a lawsuit against it. That was a really complicated, legally sensitive piece. I did several interviews for background information with people that don't even get quoted just because
it was beyond wine. You know, it's business and law and all of that stuff.
Yeah. And then I don't know, eventually, once I've kind of gathered all my pieces, then I sit down and write. And I really take my time outlining. I really take a while. Sometimes I'll take a whole afternoon, basically, to kind of look at my notes. I usually print them out. And I try to have a grip on the basic structure of the story before I really sit down and start writing. And that's mostly just to prevent myself from becoming frozen with writer's block. By the time I sit down in right. front of a Word document, I want to know where it's going.
Right. We have to take a quick break. We'll finish up when we come back. I want to talk to you about a bunch of other things, including women and wine. And a bunch of issues that relate to wine. And, of course, I want to subject you to our wine list and see what you're thinking. So we're talking to Esther Mobley. Esther is the wine critic at the San Francisco Chronicle. You're listening to The Grape Nation on Heritage Radio. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Esther.
Today's program is brought to you by our neighbors, Fine and Raw Chocolate. They make bean-to-bar chocolate and confections in HRN's backyard here in Brooklyn. Fine and Raw is committed to sustainably sourcing their cocoa beans directly from organic cocoa farmers. They use minimal processing and stone grinding to accentuate chocolate flavor and aroma. Their chocolate is sweetened exclusively with unrefined coconut sugar, which blends delicious caramel notes into the chocolate. Crafted for chocolate lovers, all of Fine and Raw's bars, truffles, and spreads are 100% plant-based. From creamy bars blended with nut butter to salt-sprinkled dark chocolate, sweet truffle bars to toasty coconut dulce de leche, Fine and Raw is obsessed with creating next-level flavors. Their chocolate hazelnut butter made with the best Oregon hazelnuts is the best thing you could ever eat with a spoon. It begs to be drizzled on ice cream, waffles, strawberries, you get the idea. Above all, Fine and Raw is a community of people dedicated to the idea that chocolate is magic. Visit fineandraw.com for your chocolate fix.
All right. All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Esther Mobley. Esther is the wine critic at the San Francisco Chronicle. Esther, tell me the years that you've been there, pushing for. In those years, tell me about some of the changes and trends, you know, that you've witnessed or, you know, sort of see ramp up at your tenure. Anything come jump out?
Yeah, I think one of the really big things that's changed in the last 4 years in wine is the importance of natural wine to the greater wine conversation. I mean, I've written a lot about it. It seems that natural wine, when, you know, kind of in the days, I loved your interview with Jenny last week, but she talking about when she was so becoming interested in natural wine, and she was really just out there. There was not much of a movement to speak of. No. I mean, think about when Alice Firing was first publishing her books, and it seemed like this really fringe thing. I think the conversation has really ramped up. There's just an incredible swell of interest in natural wine. I'm astonished. I have a lot of friends who aren't in the wine world really, and they're kind of drinking wine seriously and thoughtfully for the first time, because the natural wine movement really speaks to them. Almost every wine bar we're seeing open here is natural wine focused. I think that's just become a huge, huge part of the conversation that's impossible to ignore.
So it's not a debate and it's not a divisive issue. Natural wines have legitimately come on the scene, and people who are interested will pursue it, right? Like, you know, a bunch of your friends are interested. We don't have to compare it or talk about other stuff, because it's a pretty polarizing topic, you got to admit, right?
It's a very polarizing topic, and I completely understand why. I wish we could kind of start over and start talking about it differently. I think it can be frustrating to a lot of wine lovers, winemakers who don't identify as natural winemakers, because the implication of the existence of natural wine is that other wine is what, unnatural.
Right.
And of course, that's maybe not a fair characterization of a lot of wines. I think there's a kind of stylistic conflation of natural wine's processes with its ultimate kind of profile. And, you know, a natural wine doesn't have to be funky.
Right. There's that illusion that it is.
Right. And so I think there's a lot of really there's a lot of kind of barriers to the conversation that I want to be having about natural wine. And it's funny, I know a number of people, sommeliers, if I ever kind of express interest in it or want to talk about it, they're like, not you too. Don't tell me you've gone over to the dark side. And I'm
what
just like,
what does that mean?
Is this really where we are? I mean, I just think it's silly to ignore this major groundswell that's happening in the first place. And secondly, as a reporter, as a cultural critic, whatever I am, what a fascinating story. I mean, what an incredible thing to be observing and chronicling and writing about. I mean, it's like an avant-garde art movement or something. I'm fascinated.
I agree. You know, let it go and grow. You know, like anything else, you could pick and choose. Tell me another thing that you've noticed, you know, that's either changed, you know, moved around or is a trend on your beat.
I think one thing that's happening, and this certainly isn't confined to the last 4 years, but the energy of California wine is increasingly moving out of Napa Valley. And that's for reasons we kind of alluded to earlier, mostly based around the cost of doing business there.
Right.
This, you know, there's a kind of central story that Napa is becoming too expensive, and I feel like I'm slowly writing stories about all the little spokes on that fundamental wheel. So one thing that's happening is all the kind of ambitious, young, interesting winemakers who might live in Napa, who might have a day job in Napa, are moving out to the Sierra Foothills, to Santa Barbara.
How about the piece you did? I think they went to Europe.
Right, a couple who certainly had, you know, good, well-paying jobs. They had funds. They had cash. There's no reason why they, you know, they were in their 50s. They were experienced wine industry veterans. There was no reason why they shouldn't have been able to start something small, but they claim they couldn't even afford to buy a house in Napa.
Wow.
And then they bought a chateau in the outskirts of Bordeaux for under $500,000.
Wow.
Pretty incredible. So they're making wine there. It's this old winery and home that they purchased. And that story really seemed to resonate with a lot of people. We're just there's a bit of a brain drain from in terms of Napa winemaking talent, I think. There are certainly many exceptions. A lot of young people who are inheriting their family's businesses are staying in Napa, working for those wineries. And I think
generational change, right?
Yeah. So that's a big thing. I mean, that's another funny thing. At the Chronicle, some of my colleagues tease me that I'm on the obituary beat because we're really seeing a major generational turnover right now. And if you think about this kind of generation of people who came and started wine businesses in the 70s, the reality is that a lot of those people are reaching the ends of their lives now.
Right.
And that's part of why we're seeing so many of these big mergers and acquisitions, the big wine corporations buying the smaller wineries that simply don't have a succession plan, don't have kids in place to take it over.
Right. Acquisition has been crazy the last 5-10 years.
Crazy.
Like you were talking about Brian, that whole legal thing falls on Bettina, you know, not even her parents anymore. It's just
right.
Funny how she's in the thick of that. There's a million other things, but I want to move on. But those are, you know, two good ones, and we slipped a few things in. Can we talk about women and wine for a couple of minutes?
Yeah.
I told you off air, you know, that I thought you were a testament in the sense that one is a woman, and certainly a millennial, because we talked a little about, you know, getting one of the most coveted jobs, you know, at your ripe young age. You buck the trends. So I guess the obvious big question is, being a woman in wine still an obstacle versus men? And then, you know, for you, is age an issue? And I think your answer should sort of address, you know, what you've seen writing and, you know, covering and talking to people and yourself. You know, so I'm curious your take on that.
Well, I think, you know, there are certainly many women who have forged incredibly successful careers in wine, in all corners of it. But I do believe that it's still there's still a lot of obstacles for women. And the fact of the matter is, it's a really male-dominated business. It's a business that's really white, and I just think women who are in the wine industry. I mean, I'm a reporter, but I've kind of been in other sides of it, but it's a very social job. It's a job where there's a lot of drinking, of course.
Right.
And I think a lot of women end up being in kind of compromised positions a lot of the time. I think wine circles can often just really feel like a boys' club.
Still.
And yeah.
Still, right?
I think so.
Okay.
I mean, I just think, look at the demographics, look at the numbers. I mean, look at how many more men there are in higher up positions in wineries, in on the wine sales side of things. That's not to say that I don't think we're making really incredible strides. I mean, I look around at the wine writers who I read now, and there's certainly a lot of great male wine writers I read obsessively, but I think it's pretty incredible. I read Kelly White. I read Marissa Ross. I mean, there's just an amazing amount of youngish women who I think have really come out as writers in the last several years, and I'm thrilled by that.
Well,
but, you know,
go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, I'm sure many of your listeners will have followed the piece of satire that Ron Washam published recently about Alice Byring, and
pretty wicked.
I think that's an example of the sexism. I mean, that the idea that a man wrote that, another man published that, and that any number of people kind of looked at that and thought, "Oh, that's funny." It really took a lot of people, men and women, speaking out to start a conversation about, was that okay? Did that take it too far?
But don't you think if Alice was a guy, you know, kind of would have blown by a little quicker?
I think it wouldn't have been written that way.
Right.
I mean, maybe.
That's the gist of it.
Yeah, and so I just think when we're still in an environment where that feels somehow permissible, I mean, think about any other field that has undergone this major reckoning of its sexual politics over the last couple of years, and the wine industry really has yet to do that.
And would you agree there's still a lot of mansplaining in wine?
Absolutely, and here's something I think about a lot. You know, all of our stories on the Chronicle, this is a lot of publications are doing this nowadays, there's a little picture of the author that appears next to the byline. So I get a lot of emails from readers, and I get a lot of emails from older male readers that are completely mansplaining to me. I mean, I'm here in a position of some authority, and I'm getting these emails from people kind of explaining wine to me. And I often think, would I be getting those emails if my picture weren't next to my byline and you saw that I'm a young
woman? Good point.
I don't know. Maybe I still would. I mean, there's always going to be
different
readers out there. But
it's like when a woman psalm comes out and a bunch of old guys go, can you send the psalm over?
Exactly. You know, I mean, you're right. Or when I, you know, order wine in a restaurant and they want to give the wine list to a man I'm with. Right. I mean,
right.
I I think there's still a lot of that. And that's, you know, I am thrilled. The editor-in-chief of The Chronicle is a woman. The woman below her, who I report to, really amazing, successful women who empower other women. And I'm so thrilled to work for them and in that environment. And I know so many great, amazing women. But I check myself in my own coverage, and this goes to part of what you asked. You know, I'm aware that I end up writing about a lot of men. And the last three winemakers of the year that I've named have been men. Mm. There's a lot of great women out there. It's not for lack of women. And I'm sure I need to be more thoughtful in my own coverage about trying to be more representative of the true diversity of who's out there.
Step one is awareness, which is good. Yeah. Step two is acting. So you're aware, you know, now you take the time and figure out how to act. But I agree with all of that. Without incriminating your past employer, you know, I think the Chronicle gives you more leeway to write about a lot more stuff, where your old employer just seemed like, to me, not putting words in your mouth, you know, talking more to that men's club. Agree?
Well, it's a completely different readership. So,
right.
You know, anyone who's
more complex
a subscriber to Wine Spectator, they're more interested in wine. They're interested in a different type of wine. Right. And they're very thoughtful about that. I mean, when I was there, I remember we would have meetings and they would have done these really detailed surveys of who our readers are, what they are interested in, what their income is. And so I think they know who their audience is. I think we all have to question who will our audience be 10 or 15 years from now.
Right.
But absolutely, I love that I now, in my current role, really get to write for people like me and like my friends.
Right.
And that's much
more
interesting.
You're
more
comfortable with that. All right, listen, yeah. I had a list of things I wanted to get your take on, but we're running out of time because I want to do the wine list. But you get to pick one of them and spend a minute on it. I wanted to get your take on, and let me list them all and you pick one. I wanted to get your take on social media and the internet, how it applies to wine. I wanted to either get your take on millennials. Climate change, I think, has come on the surface. I think you've addressed natural wine a little. So pick one of those and let's just talk about a quick take on that.
How about climate change?
Okay.
So, it's funny. How about climate change? And then I probably don't know any more than you do about how it's ultimately going to affect wine. But I think about climate change in the context of wine all the time. I think if you look at where historic temperature trends have gone, there's no question that in many of our premier wine regions, there's a warming pattern. And in the short term, I think that's actually led to some really successful vintages in Europe, in the U.S., in a lot of places. I mean, I think maybe we'll look back on this era as a really kind of sweet spot of ripeness. We can get the grapes pretty ripe. But I am not convinced that as climate change continues, that we'll be able to grow the same grape varieties in the same places we do now. I mean, of course, people like to cite examples like the rise of England as a sparkling wine region,
right,
or look at a place like British Columbia that has just been on the rise, probably in no small part due to climate change. But it's not just warming temperatures. Here in California, we are thinking constantly about drought and
which could lead to fires
and just all of the erratic weather patterns. But at the same time, we've also had flooding and really excessive amounts of precipitation. We're seeing the rise of insects and, you know, harmful pests in vineyards that didn't exist many years ago. Pierce's disease, people don't talk about it as much, but that's a major threat to a place like Napa Valley. They're working really hard to figure out how that's going to work.
Right.
So
that's behind the scenes stuff, you know, that people don't hear about. You and I could probably do a show on climate change because you know, it does have a direct effect, but we have to end it there because I want to do the wine list. We have about 5 minutes left, which is forcing me to rush you, but I think you can handle the task. So this is our weekly wine list. We ask our guests the same 5 questions, try to get a little insight into, you know, what you're drinking. So don't dwell on these. Don't overthink them. And give me your best answer. So the first question is, what are you drinking now? And that's in the context of, you know, what are you trying? Does the season affect what you're drinking? Are you tasting through stuff, you know, for writing? So what's in the fridge? What's on the table?
Well, I have about 16 open bottles of wine in the fridge, which is okay. Difficult for me. But one thing I'm working on a story right now about Charbonneau, which is this kind of mostly forgotten heritage
white
grape variety in California. It's red wine. It originates in France's Savoie, and there's very little of it left. There was a lot more planted at the turn of the 20th century. But now there's just this kind of, there's a few vineyards that still have some in Calistoga.
I know I've had Turley.
Yeah, exactly. Turley, they used to make a Charbonneau. They no longer do. There's a surprising, I mean, there's about 20 producers that still make California Charbonneau.
Give me one or two for people to seek out.
One great one is Toffanelli.
T-O-F-A-N-E-L-L-I?
Correct.
Okay.
And it's this guy, Vince Toffanelli. He owns a vineyard in Calistoga. He farms. He may be one of the only people in California who legitimately farms his own grapes, and I mean he's in the tractor, and makes his own wine with his hands. I mean, you just don't, and owns the land. He's a great old-timer. His Charbonneau is beautiful. It ages really well. It's a really tannic wine. It's kind of an Italian-like
right.
wine, but it's bright, and it's really easy drinking. Another thing, I have a lot of Australian Riesling I've been going through lately. I love Australian Riesling, and I spent too much of my life not drinking it. Now I'm really enjoying it.
Give me a maker that you're enjoying.
I love Pewsey Vale.
Spell that.
Australia's Eden Valley. P-E-W-S-E-Y.
Okay.
And then Vale, V-A-L-E.
L-E. All right,
And those wines can age. Don't be afraid to hold them back.
Right. Charbonneau is definitely a first. So is Toffanelli and Australian Riesling. When you talk Riesling, you don't always go to Australia. All right. Esther's favorite wine and food pairing. It's our goofy question.
Ooh.
But what? It's not something you eat every week or every month. But, you know, what's memorable to you? What goes well?
I love, like, champagne with popcorn. That's not a revolutionary.
You're not the
idea,
first person, but that fried foods and salty foods, that's a very fun combination. You know what our grape nation rule is. You can't say champagne and oysters, so thank God you didn't do that.
Well, I wouldn't be opposed to drinking that either.
No, I love that.
The other thing is, I know it's not fashionable, but I love dessert wine. I really love great dessert wine, and I love, like, Sauternes or Trappist-Baranauschleza with, like, a fruit dessert, like, let's say a fruit tart.
Okay.
Yeah.
Those are good ones. Yeah. All right. Favorite wine restaurant and or bar, and these are places with a slant, you know, towards selection, knowledge, creative. You can give me... You could stay in San Fran, maybe Napa, you know, give me a couple, you know, and don't be, you know, you're not being exclusive. If you leave people out, that doesn't mean you don't love them or whatever, but who does it well?
Good. Well, I'm going to give you three. One is a wine bar, and it's just a few blocks from where I live here in San Francisco. It's called High Treason.
Okay.
It's a fabulous wine bar. It's run by John Vuong and Michael Ireland, two guys who abandoned kind of Michelin star song jobs to start this hip, very casual wine bar. They always bring in winemakers to be DJs for a night and spin records. And they have just an enormous by-the-glass list every night. And whenever I go in there, I always discover something new. They can always pour for me something I've never had before, and I love that.
Nice to have it local. All right, what else?
Yeah. And then there's two other great, great wine restaurants in San Francisco that remind me in some ways a lot of each other. They're both in the Mission, which is a neighborhood I used to live in.
Right.
One is called Heirloom Cafe.
Right.
It's run by this guy, Matt Strauss. The other is called The Morris, and it's run by Paul Einbun.
Right.
You might know Paul. So both are really wine-focused restaurants. They're owned by wine guys. And both Paul and Matt started their restaurants in order to serve wine. Both restaurants, I think what really sets them apart for me is the wine lists are really built on both of those guys' personal cellars. They've been stocking up wine for years, both with the dream of then opening their own restaurant.
Right.
And the food in both places is fabulous. I love going there. But in both cases, you're really getting the individual kind of playlist of these brilliant minds. And I just love that. You can feel their passion for the wines they've stocked. They're not always the wines you would expect to have in such quantity and depth of verticals, but both are great places, The Morris and Heirloom.
Esther? That's how you answer that question. Spot on. All right. Esther's favorite all-time wine. It used to be the most expensive, the rarest, you know, one time. It's evolved away from that. It's become, you know, experiential or, you know, the first time you tried whatever, even a Lambrusco. What's an all-time wine that, you know, is memorable to you or impressionable or was important?
It's so hard to pick one. I feel like I have a wine epiphany every week. But, I mean, so my first trip to Burgundy was, my first and only trip to Burgundy was really eye-opening for me. And I can say, I think with certainty, that the best wine I tasted in Burgundy was Georges de Vogue, Les Amoureux, a Premier Cru in Mucigny. I love that wine. And if I ever make it big, make it rich, I will buy a bottle of that wine.
But okay.
That's one of the most memorable
wines I drank
on a memorable wine trip. Yeah.
All right, so let's leave it at that. All right, let's wrap this up because we got to wrap the show. We're running late already. Give me, and you should be able to answer this, best wine around $15-$20. Give me a red, give me a white. You can give me a region. You can give me a grape. You can give me specific stuff. But, you know, you've heard me say this before. My kids are going to a party. They're not going to spend $8-$9 and look like schmucks. They're not going to spend $30-$40 because they don't have it. That sweet spot could be around $15-$17-$18-$20. Give me a red, give me a white.
Okay, so those can be really hard to find in California, unfortunately. But
think
I'm
broader, you know, think
you,
global.
No, I'm going California.
Okay.
It's easy to be like, oh, Beaujolais or...
There you go.
But it's possible to find them in California. So one great wine for closer to $20 is a producer called Birikino. That's B-I-R-I-C-H-I-N-O.
Right.
And it's these two guys based in Santa Cruz. They make a beautiful Grenache from the Bassan Vineyard that I think hovers just under $20, like it might be $19. And it's gorgeous. It's the kind of direction a lot of California Grenache is going right now, which is this very lightly extracted, kind of pale, very floral, restrained example, and I just love that. It's a beautiful wine.
Give me a white.
A white? Okay, so actually from a similar region, but the guy I named winemaker of the year last year in 2018 is a winemaker named Ian Brand. He's based in Monterey, and I just think he's producing some of the best values in California wine today.
Spell his last name?
Brand, B-R-A-N-D.
Oh, like it sounds. Okay.
Of Brand.
Okay.
And he makes a beautiful Chardonnay that's under $20 under his label called Le Petit Paysan, the little peasant.
Right.
And to me, it is what I want a Chardonnay to be at an even higher price point. It's got tension. It's not just a kind of sleek, razor-like, zingy thing. It's got some body. It's got some texture. But ultimately, it's it's a wine that's driven by acid. It's a coastal wine. It's a Monterey wine that you get all this kind of saline sea character from. And I never want a Chardonnay to be any more than that.
It sounds great. I forgot to tell everyone, I post all our answers on our social media. So everything you mentioned, you know, I will eventually post on Facebook and Instagram, because the whole reason for doing this is to turn people on, you know, to some of these recommendations. Esther, I told you the hour would go quickly. We've run late.
It certainly did.
We have to wrap up. Let me do our closing. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby, and you can follow the hashtag The Grape Nation. On Facebook, we're at The Grape Nation, and on Twitter, we're at BenRuby. I know it's confusing, but whatever. Also, subscribe to The Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Like I said, we'll post Esther's wine list on our social media sites. Esther, we didn't talk about it, but you do other writings in other places. You mentioned, you know, maybe you didn't. But where can we find you on social media and all your wine writings?
You can find all my wine writing at sfchronicle.com/wine.
Okay.
You can also, I have a personal website, esthermobley.com, where I also post all my stories. You can find me on Instagram at Esther Mob, ESTHERMOB.
Right.
And that's about it.
Okay. All right. Esther, I want to thank you. I made an exception. We did Esther by phone because obviously Esther's based out in California. June is Women and Wine Month. I thought it would be important to have Esther on, and it was worth it for me to put her through a phone line. But as I requested earlier, when you come to New York, you promised me that we would get together and raise a glass.
Absolutely.
I want you to confirm that. So Esther, thank you. Good luck with everything. We'll continue to read all your stuff. Thank you to our engineer, Amanda, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam BenRuby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.